All right, let's do it. Let's do it. I'm ready. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready too. I'm hype about it.
You're not hype. Shut up.
I'm hype.
You're not hype.
Don't yell at me, Scott. It hurts my feelings. Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome.
It's a podcast where I'm hype about wine and movies.
Guys, Jamie turns 37 in 2 days after this recording. I think, Jamie, you have to put out a Twitter or an Instagram poll, and we have to find out from the audience, at what point is it inappropriate for you to describe yourself as hype? I feel like 37 has to be the cutoff. You're entering your late 30s. You're closer to 40 than you are to 30. I think you have to retire saying that you're hype.
Don't be so damn prescriptivist with language around me, Scott. I'm going to use it the way I want to use it.
This isn't even a prescriptivist thing. This is an ageist thing. I'm saying you're embarrassing yourself, Jamie. You're Steve Buscemi.
And you're embarrassing yourself with your ageism.
No, I feel pretty good about that, actually. I feel very comfortable telling you what is and is not appropriate for a man of your stature and age to be doing.
I'm really glad that we have that on mic.
You wear a cardigan to work, Jamie, all right? You're too old to say hype. If you described yourself as hype in front of your students, what percentage of the class would roll their eyes at you?
I have, in fact, described myself as hype in front of the class, and 100% of them rolled their eyes.
There's your answer, buddy. Anyway, this is a podcast about movies and wine. It's a podcast about movies and wine.
I am what I am, and that's all that I am. And for those of you in the audience who don't know shit about one or both of these topics, movies and wine, my name's Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
Yes, he is Jamie. He is the wine guy. I am Scott. I am the movie guy. I'm drinking some Pinot Grigio. Normally, each week, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves. However, we're trying something different.
Normally, we'll tell you why we like them, how they're made, why they work. Hopefully, we find pairings that work. Sometimes we don't, but today, we're doing something a little bit different. Welcome to our new miniseries, Pinot Grigio versus the M4trix, or
Can I do this one? I feel like I've got it. Can I try this one?
Okay, you go ahead.
The packet in front of you has our focus group research. Inside, you'll find the breakdown, including keyword associations with the brand, the top two being Pinot and Grigio, which I think are great things to keep in mind as you begin working on Matrix 4. And who knows how many more.
Excellent Christina Ricci there,
Thank
Scotty.
You. Killer one-scene performance from Christina Ricci.
She really, really is.
Question for you before we get into the rest of the introduction to the miniseries. The Christina Ricci marketing executive character. So in the movie, we established that there are a bunch of bots, right? Like
handler bots.
Jude and the handler who works with Tiffany at her bike shop are like they're not actual people. They're just programmed to look like people, right? And behave like people.
Yep.
Do we think she is a bot or is she a person?
I think she's a person who has drunk the Kool-Aid. I think to like extend the metaphor that she stands for, she's got to be an actual human being who's just so into the studio.
And the brand.
And the brand.
And word associations with the brand and the IP.
And she thinks she's doing the best job by communicating the way that she does.
I mean, she's, you know, probably going to, well, I mean, I don't know, because the marketing on this movie did not generate the jabillions of dollars that that Warner Brothers would have wanted. Did I tell you that Warner Brothers is being sued by Village Roadshow over this movie?
You did not.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Village Roadshow is the Australian production company who has produced all four Matrix movies, like as co-productions with Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers handles, you know, some of the financing and the distribution. And Village Roadshow is suing for the same reason that Scarlett Johansson sued Disney, because apparently Warner's released the Matrix Resurrections on streaming without checking with their co-financing partner first, and Village Roadshow feels like that really fucked the movie in terms of its potential financial windfall, and they are suing, and we're going to see what happens, but they're probably going to settle out of court just like Disney and ScarJo did, because this movie is tanking mega hard.
This whole new landscape for film releases is just like it boggles the mind of someone like me.
Well, for someone like me, like, I know it better than you do, and it's fucking buck wild, man. It's a strange new world that we're living in. It's kind of working out for, you know, I'm effectively a shut-in at this point, and, like, I'm getting to see a bunch of shit way easier. But then you look at somebody, like, we were just talking about Kimmy, right? New Steven right. Soderbergh movie that premiered on HBO Max, didn't even go to theaters.
Speaking of shut-ins.
Well, yeah, of course. But the reason I mention it is that Soderbergh has been trying to get to this point for 15 years. his interest in doing unconventional and like online or at home release strategy started, I think, back in 2008, maybe, with this little movie called Bubble that he produced for like no money with a bunch of non-actors. And he tried to release it online as like a pay what you wish thing. And there was like a small theatrical, and he just like, he keeps experimenting because he's a guy who's like, look, I get it. The market for adult dramas that I like to make has basically evaporated, and I don't want to be irresponsible with somebody's money. So like, let's try different things. And now it feels like, thanks to COVID, the world has caught up to Steven Soderbergh's plans, and he must be super happy that he gets to make movies for grownups that like get big releases at home where people might watch them.
That is really great. Although I disagree. Go on ahead and be irresponsible with other people's money.
But then when you do that, like, you know, they don't always let you have their money again.
That's fine. Find someone else's money to be irresponsible with.
Well, but we were just talking about this. We were just talking about Francis Ford Coppola. Like, Francis Ford Coppola spent decades in the wilderness because nobody wanted to give him money to make his projects because, you know, sometimes he went over budget and over schedule and it was irresponsible with their money. Like, you got to play their game, Jamie, or you got to get a sugar daddy. Get one of those Allisons. Fuck.
Christ. Okay, I'm done talking about this for the moment. I'm sure we'll return to this topic. Can we finish introducing the episode?
Oh, yeah. This is all getting cut.
This is definitely staying in.
So this I actually, Jamie, I want to push back a little bit because this is not our new miniseries. We're more than halfway through, baby.
It is.
This is the fourth episode in our bizarre, convoluted journey, making forced parallels between the finest of all white wine grapes that Jamie wants to talk about for six episodes, Pinot Grigio, and our beloved fourth installment in the Wachowskis' Matrix franchise, 2021's The Matrix Resurrections.
Today, the Pinot Gris that we have on the table is the Red Newt Cellars Kerry Creek Vineyard 2013 Pinot Gris. It is available direct from the winery. That's rednewtcellars.com for $28.
Let's just get into it, Jamie. I think it's nummy. I think it's super nums. I have other things to say.
But you like it?
It's nums. It's real nums. I think I like it the most of all the Pinot Gris and Grigios that we've had so far.
I like it a lot, too. I'm glad you like it.
Yeah. Anyway, on my side, on the super granular, obsessive movie side of things, I want to focus today just on three characters, or possibly six characters. Tom / Neo, Tiffany / Trinity, and Smith / Smith, played respectively by Keanu Reeves, Carrie Ann Moss, and fucking Jonathan Groff.
Jonathan motherfucking Groff.
Oh, my God. He's so good. He's so good. They're all great. But like Groff feels like a revelation to me in this movie. So we'll get into that.
Yes. Yes, we will. Let's get into the wine first.
Indeed. I've got my little glass right here and I'm going to drink some.
Yeah. Give it a little taste. I want you to tell me what you think of. I mean, you already, the lead is out there already. You like the wine.
I do.
But give me a little bit more. What do you think?
Well, so first of all, I should set the table for you. So last night I had this wine. I cooked with it a little bit. I was making a ragu and I didn't have any red wine, but I had this bottle that I was about to open. So I put like half a cup in it and then had this with the ragu with some penne. By my child's request, he wanted the three-color penne for dinner. So we had that with some sauce. I got to say, I do like the wine more with the sauce. I feel like the acidity of the tomato sauce kind of brought out the sweetness, whether it's actual sweetness or residual sugar or whatever the fuck you're going to tell me I'm wrong about. But I do think it tasted better with a nice acidic tomato sauce. So not terribly aromatic. Am I on the right page here? Like it's not, I'm not getting the sniffs from like 6 inches away from the glass.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it neutral in the way that like we talked about the Scarbolo was a little bit more muted. Or sorry, the Schioppetto.
The Schioppetto was nasally muted.
But you're right. This isn't jumping out of the glass.
On the body, is it medium plus? It feels fairly viscous, right?
It's a little weighty.
Yeah, a little weighty. I can't tell about. I mean, there's no tannins, but about phenolic bitterness compounds. Are there those there? There's some kind of bitterness on the finish, but not a ton.
Oh, they exist, but I mean, if you recall the Chauffite from last week,
I totally do. Hang on, I'm going to refer to my notes. The Chauffite from last week, let's see. Nuttiness, saline, bitter finish, citrus, starburst, burn at the back bitter of the finish. Throat, cardamom, ?
Yep. Yeah. So the Chauffite definitely was showing a higher level of phenolic bitterness.
Well, let's see. What else do I got here? So there, it's like super bright. That was the first thing that hit me. Very bright. Is that correct? This is a bright wine?
I would call it bright.
Citrus right off the bat, as always with white wines. I was getting pineapple. Is it like a recurring thing with the Pinot Gris and Pinot Griggs, the coconut? Because I was getting coconut as well. Not as strong as some of the others, but definitely a coconut thing.
I don't get coconut, but go on with your bad self.
Right. Well, shut up. I get coconut. Facts versus opinions, Jamies. Let's see. There's some kind of green fruit, not a green vegetative thing that we've talked about before, but like definitely a green fruit that's like tropical.
Is it like a green apple or like a kiwi?
Not a green apple, like a kiwi. So I wrote down kiwi, and then there was a green sweet and bitter thing that I was detecting that I couldn't place. And then I looked at the label on the back of the bottle. By the way, pass on my compliments to your friends at Red Nude Cellars for like actually putting like charts and details and information on the back of the label, which is just very nice. I just really appreciate that when these labels aren't just leaving me, you know, in the lurch. But on the back of the label, it says lychee. And having read that, yes, I agree. There are notes of lychee in this, and I can't believe that I know what lychee tastes like, but I do. And I think it's in here.
I agree. I think it's pretty lychee-y.
It weirdly reminded me of soju.
Huh. Interesting.
The like one bottle I had of soju when I got very drunk drinking wine and soju when we recorded our Parasite episode.
Oh, that's right. You had soju while we were recording that. I didn't have any
wine.
Soju.
Yeah. And then I also didn't record half the episode and we had to do it all over again. Probably because of the wine and the soju.
Oh, my God. Man,
that was a year ago, Jamie.
That was... It could have been anywhere from yesterday to 10 years ago, right, honestly,
it's all a brain soup. It's all soup. I have no recollection of when things happened in the last 2 years.
It's not a good soup either. It's a bad soup.
No, it's a gruel. It's pretty thin.
Yes. Thank you. That was very evocative.
Very, very appetizing descriptions of food. So I'm objectively right in all of my flavor notes.
I think so. You know, if I were to offer you any like technical critique, I think that the coconut that you're detecting, I think that's probably more in the land of like mascarpone and cheese rind and indicators of Lee's aging. But if coconut is an indicator for you of Lee's aging, then that's also fine.
I think on a recurring basis, maybe it has been. Yeah.
And we've talked about it a couple of times, and I've said this same thing a couple of times. So like, you know, if you ever get into blind tasting in a dedicated way, which I know that you won't, you know, coconut would be your indicator for that particular winemaking thing.
Jamie, you don't know me. You don't know my future. You don't know what I'm going to get into.
Scott.
Jamie.
I, of people in the world, like I might not know you the best, but I'm certainly in the top five. And I can say with some certainty, you're not getting into blind tasting in a meaningful way.
Well, you said with some certainty that bottle of wine that you gave me for my birthday, that like I was just going to drink it right away. It's been almost 2 months and I haven't opened that bottle.
We'll see how much longer that goes.
I also think I forgot where I put it.
See, that helps.
Yeah.
In the aging of wine. Forgetting that you have it, super duper helpful.
One question. Sweetness. I'm detecting some sweetness in this. The label says that this is medium dry.
Yes.
But I don't agree. I think it's sweet. Maybe it's just the sweetest wine we've had because you don't like doing sweet wines on the show?
Yeah. So a sweet wine, like you see on the back of this, you have the dry, medium sweet, sweet scale, which comes from the International Riesling Foundation. It's sort of a standardized scale for sweetness in wine. A wine that is sweet would have somewhere north of, you know, 20 grams or so residual sugar, something like 20% residual sugar. And you'll see on the back of this wine that it's 3.2% residual sugar. And then TA is titratable acidity.
Titratable acidity. Man, they're really going detailed.
Yeah, I love that they put those details on this bottle.
It's really super nice. I feel it feels less it I know you hate this word, but it demystifies the wine.
I agree.
I want you to say it, Jamie. Say it. Say the DM word.
Nope, not gonna do it.
It demystifies the wine.
It is quite educational. And I think particularly when you're talking about wines where you can expect differing levels of residual sugar. the scale here, the dry to sweet scale, is very, very helpful.
All right. Well, so we did my notes. We talked about what I think and my objectively correct flavor profile on this. What else are you getting, Jamie? What do you think is in here?
All right. So for me, the fruit profile is definitely like the tropical stuff is definitely there, but I also get a ton of like dried and candied fruit. So like dried apple slices, dried mango slices. It's got almost like a confectionery thing going on, like peach rings or gummy worms.
Oh, Jamie, we got in trouble last time we talked about peach rings.
Did we?
Yeah, because people immediately pointed out that clearly we did not know that peach ring is a euphemism for a sex act.
That's right. And then we
took that 1 minute conversation in which we both said, we argued about who liked peach rings more or less, and put it on internet as an audiogram. And then, you know.
And then there was a thing. Whatever. Peach rings are delicious. I'm sure the sex act is fine too. So the wine is showing a lot of dried, candied, confectionery fruit for me. There's also this like nutty, like marzipan kind of thing happening, as well as some saffron, a little bit of that honeysuckle and ginger thing that I've talked about a bunch before. There's also this like white button mushroom note to this wine. There's the like confectionery sweet side of the wine, and then there's also this savory side of this wine, which I find really, really compelling. There's a bunch of residual sugar, decent amount of acidity. I'm totally with you. I think this wine is, as you would say, super nums.
It's super nums. I can't help it. It's very nummy.
It's extremely nummy. Let's talk about the style of this wine and sort of the influences that it has.
Let's.
If you gave this wine to me blind, I would probably assume that it was from Alsace.
Okay, why?
Because of all the similarities that it has to the wine from last week. You know, we talked about the Chauffite in it being very ripe and fruit forward, but also that it had botrytis influence. It had that saffron, honeysuckle, ginger situation going on. It had a little bit of minerality, a touch of residual sugar. It was much more bitter than this wine is, but that can be variable wine to wine. I think that, you know, on my absolute best day, I might be able to get to the Finger Lakes because I've tasted a lot of Finger Lakes wine. But for any blind taster who's much more familiar with Pinot Gris as it comes from Oregon, Alsace, Northern Italy, you're very clearly going to go to Alsace because that's the style, this ripeness framed by a little bit of sugar and botrytis influence. The thing that makes this Finger Lakes for me, or American for me, is that it's a little bit softer. It doesn't have that bitter finish. It doesn't have the hard edges of the Domaine Chauffite. The fruit is a little bit more, it doesn't do this thing where like on the nose, it's super ripe, but on the palate, it's a little bit sharper and tartar. It does the opposite thing where on the nose, it is ripe, but on the palate, it's still like really pillowy, ripe, easygoing. And that for me indicates a wine from the United States.
It is pillowiness and easygoingness.
Yes.
Okay. Why? Why? What is it about? And this is not just a Finger Lakes thing. This is an American thing. You're saying American wines are more pillowy than, is it Europe in general or just Alsatian wines?
Europe in general. And it's because of a generally warmer climate.
And that leads to pillowiness.
Yes.
Can we explain what that is? Because it's been a while since I've called you out on describing a wine as pillowy.
I mean, I think pillowy is a new one for our podcast.
We've definitely talked about pillowy wines. And I believe your justification for the term was it's like landing on a nice soft pillow, which I did not find an acceptable definition, nor would sixth grade teacher.
We run into this thing a lot where, you know, English is not great for describing flavors. We don't have enough words, and so we have to be abstract.
It's a poor craftsman who blames his tools, Jamie. It's a poor craftsman who blames his tools.
Fucking English is bad for this. I'm sorry. There's no two ways about it.
But there can be a better word to describe a flavor than a euphemism for bedding, right?
You would think that, but I don't think that that's true. I think that being abstract about it and, you know, sort of reconciling those two things in your head as you are drinking the wine is a better way to understand it.
Okay, but I still don't know what pillowy means.
It means soft. It has a softness to it. It's not sharp. It is. I don't know what else to give you here, honestly. If you taste the wine and you think about the European wines that we've had in this miniseries, this one for me is very clearly softer on the palate. It is less harsh. It gives you a sense of welcomeness, of being welcomed.
We're just getting further into abstractions here.
Yes. Yes, we are. And at some point during us doing this podcast, you're going to need to be comfortable with that.
I will never be comfortable for your answer to a question about what does this euphemism mean being to take us even further into euphemism. I don't find that acceptable.
Taste the wine and think about the things that I'm saying.
Jamie, what do you think I've been doing?
Yeah, man, I got nothing for you.
You're also talking about it in terms of like, you're giving me a euphemism, and then when you explain it, you're telling me it's not something, right? You're telling me it's not harsh. I'm ready to put this to bed. I'm sure it's annoying people who are listening at home, and while it's annoying you, that doesn't bother me as much. But like, it's soft, it's not harsh, it's welcoming, and I guess I just have to deal with that. That seems to be your final answer.
That's basically it. The last thing that I can give you is that the texture of the wine is a little silky.
That's something I can work with, like a silk pillowcase.
There you go.
All right. See, there you go. That's like an actual textural description. Thank you.
You are welcome.
I feel placated. You may now move along with the things you actually want to discuss.
Oh, God. Okay. So that softness and the less of a change from nose to palate on the wine and the lower bitterness, the sort of welcoming nature of this wine points me towards non-European wine, generally speaking. One of the triumphs of this wine, I think, is that it is harder to make a wine in this style in the Finger Lakes than it is in Alsace. One of the reasons for that is it's a much, much wetter area than Alsace is. Alsace sees like incredibly low rainfall, and soils are incredibly well draining. When you get botrytis influence, that fungal thing on your grapes,
fungal pressure,
there is very, very low chance of that turning into gray rot, which is the bad side of botrytis.
Right. Not the noble rot, but the bad rot.
Correct. And annoyingly, it's the same species of fungus. It's just like when it gets too far, it becomes gray rot. And you can actually smell it in the air. Like as you pass vineyards, you can smell this like vinegary, spoiled juice smell. It's horrible. But with higher humidity comes a much higher chance of that happening. It's also less sunny in the Finger Lakes than it is in Alsace. The way Alsace is situated, they receive many, many more daylight hours than the Finger Lakes does. That's mitigated in this wine's case by the fact that it's located in the southeastern edge of Seneca Lake, which is an area that they call affectionately the banana hammock.
Okay, do go on.
It's an area that is bathed in sunshine for longer than the rest of the lake is, just sort of because of the topography. And it's the southeast corner, and because of the shape of it, late in the day, you see this sort of golden arch of sunshine that looks like a banana.
Okay. And from there, we go to a metaphor for a dick cradling Speedo.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're in America. We like to make dick jokes.
Well, I mean, that's true. Dick jokes are just funny. There's nothing we can that's do right. about that. They're just funny.
They are just objectively funny. There's not like if you see that thing and you're like, hey, that looks kind of like a banana. What are you going to do?
Are you not going to compare it to a penis?
I certainly would.
You and I have never skipped an opportunity to make a dick joke, good or bad. Like, we always take that chance.
Always take the chance. Yeah, I agree.
So, Jamie, you have spent time with the Red Newt Sellers folk, right?
I sure have. Yeah, I worked Harvest with these guys in 2020.
Well, what is their deal and why do you, like, I know you like working with them, but like, what about them makes you want to talk about their wines?
I think that I would want to talk about their wines whether or not I spent time with them. And in fact, part of the reason why I spent time with them is that I love their wines. In spending time with them, I found that they are really, really intelligent, engaged, thoughtful people. One of the things that they really, really do well, both with inside the winery and without, with the wider region, is collaborate. And I think that that really started in the very beginning. The winery was founded in 1998 by Dave and Deborah Whiting. They had gotten married in the 1980s, and Dave had worked around the Finger Lakes at several wineries, being cellar master, assistant winemaker, etc. And Deborah, when they met, was a microbiologist at Cornell. Smart lady.
I imagine Cornell's microbiology program is no slouch.
Probably not. But of course, she decided to leave science in favor of a career in food, which, as a person with a career in food and wine, I question. But then again, I think she helped build something truly, truly excellent.
Yeah, didn't you also start pursuing a career in science and then ended up in a career in food and wine?
Yes, yes, I did.
So maybe you can just back off with your questioning of her decisions.
Sure, I could.
Maybe you could
but
just
also,
step off, Jamie.
I question off. My own decisions, I think is the point.
Jamie, you don't have to question your own decisions. I'm here to question your decisions for you.
Fuck you, buddy.
I got your back.
Yeah, yeah, I know you do. So anyway, in the years leading up to opening the winery, Deb worked at some catering companies and a bakery in the area. And then by the time 98 rolled around and they were ready to embark on this project, she was ready to head up the culinary side of the operation. Red Newt was, from the outset, to be both a winery and a restaurant, which is a pretty lofty goal, I would say. So that's a lot of moving parts to manage. So Dave took on the winemaking side, Deb took on the culinary side, and Deborah was a very early devotee of the farm-to-table movement. We know about farm-to-table now, and it's almost de rigueur at this point in higher-quality restaurants. But in the 90s, it was a lot less known, especially outside of cities, for a restaurant like this to cultivate the kind of relationships with local farms such that nearly 100% of the ingredients coming into the kitchen were Finger Lakes regional ingredients is pretty remarkable.
There's a lot of farming going on up there?
There is a lot of farming going on up there. I mean, upstate New York is very agricultural in nature. You know, you get north of the panhandle, it's farmland. New York State is some of the best places to grow onions are up there. That's a famous crop of the area. But they do an awful lot of dairy farming as well, and a fair bit of beef farming. It's pretty diverse across the whole state. Yeah, so I think it's incredibly cool that over the course of her time heading the kitchen at Red Newt Bistro, she brought the kitchen to the point where the only ingredients that came in that weren't regionally specific were cocoa, vanilla, sugar, coffee, and black pepper. I think that's massively impressive, and it speaks to this spirit of collaboration, because this is all born of Deborah making relationships with local farms and farmers. Regrettably, she passed away in 2011. It was devastating across the region because she had become such a pillar of the community. Also, obviously, personally devastating to Dave, who within the next few years would pass his winemaking responsibilities to Kelby James Russell, who's the current winemaker, and he would take over the kitchen himself. The kitchen at Red Newt is not the full service kitchen that it once was, but it still places a premium on ingredients all coming from in the Finger Lakes.
Do they have good grubs up there? I know you worked in their tasting room for a little while, right?
Yeah, they do. Really, really good and well-sourced cheese and charcuterie boards, some really cool desserts that go along with the wines. It's an impressive operation that they run.
Jamie, give me off the top of your head, I'm putting you on the spot here. What's your favorite thing that you had on the menu up there?
Probably the cheese board.
Yeah.
It's a tour of dairies from around the Finger Lakes, which is really, really fun to taste local cheese with local wine. In the wine community, we talk a lot about like Epoisse being a great cheese with Burgundy because that's the cheese that is there, or like Emmental with Savoie wines. So it's a fun experience to see what the local fermentation culture is and how they interact.
I don't want to sidebar us completely because I don't want to, but well, here we go. Is this a T-word thing? Is that why it's good to have the local cheese with the local wine?
Yes.
T-word.
And to be an accomplice in not sidebarring us, I will say no more.
Wonderful. Good choice.
The other thing about this spirit of collaboration and partnership is the model that the winery itself has in its acquisition of grapes. Red Newt Cellars doesn't own any vines. They're what we in the wine world would call a négociant house.
That's a fancy French word.
It is a fancy French word with origins in Burgundy. Essentially, this is a winery that doesn't own any land and that develops partnerships with local farmers, sometimes having long-term contracts, other times just sort of handshake agreements around the supply of fruit. And there's typically, and definitely in the case of Red Newt Cellars, a collaboration between the winemaker and the farmer to make the best decision about farming practices and pick dates that serve both the farm and the winery.
You had talked about when we did our first episode in this mini-series, and I was talking about the more European conception of the auteur theory and about how it's hard to apply that to wine because it's so much more collaborative. And I pushed back on that because a lot of the hurdles and barriers that you were saying that made it, you know, that auteur theory couldn't apply to wine, I found parallels in the movies. But this feels like really not revolutionarily collaborative, but like at least to my understanding of how wine is made. Like these guys don't own any grapes. They don't own – they're not even a vineyard. They are just a wine maker, and it's all about collaboration with these other grape growers that they deal with.
Yes, correct.
That – I don't know. That kind of – that's fascinating.
It fits more for sure.
I like that ethos. Like I really like that ethos, especially about like them not owning the land, you know, about that their process is they're not vertically integrated, right? They're not – they don't own the land and the grapes and they do the tilling and they check on the vines and then they're making the finished product and then they're selling it and they have the tasting room. Like they're more right. about a community, like an agricultural community. That's very interesting to me and surprising.
There's something to be said for both ways, right?
Like for sure.
If you are a small winery and you own, a couple acres of land that you tend and then you also harvest and make the wine, then you are in control of everything start to finish. In the winter, you do your pruning and you do it exactly the way you want to do it. And then in the springtime, you train your vines and tie them up and make sure that they are the way that you want them to be. And then in the summertime, you do canopy management and then you are the only limiting factor when it comes to pick dates. But that also is just a huge tonnage of work and doesn't allow for a whole other brain in the scenario, which could offer you better or at the very least different ideas. I very much like the idea of collaboration because I don't think that anyone could possibly be both the best farmer and the best winemaker at the same time.
Right. You either have to be like once in a generation fucking great at it or you have to sacrifice. You're either a winemaker who is also a farmer or a farmer who makes wine sometimes.
Right. Now, larger estate wineries that, you know, have a certain volume, of course, they employ a winemaker and a vineyard manager. And those people collaborate, and it's still, you know, owned by whoever owns the place, but they, you know, the specialties are split. But I like the idea of farmers farming their land and winemakers making the wine. And this allows for, you know, someone like Kelby, who's the winemaker now, to source grapes from other places in addition to his long-term projects, and allows him to be, I think, a little bit more creative, do some experimental lots, do some, you know, small lot fermentation to see if maybe they want to bring a new vineyard into the portfolio. I like the experimentation that goes on year to year.
You told me that there's an audacity to the methodology at Red Newt. Is that what you're talking about? The way that Kelby experiments with like small batches and experimenting with new grapes from different suppliers? Is that the audacity that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's certainly one of the things that I'm talking about. You know, they have a well-established enough at this point core of products. So he is free to experiment. But even just at the beginning of the winery, you know, I talked about how they were opening up during a time when farm-to-table restaurants weren't really a thing. Well, also in the Finger Lakes, wineries that focused on dry single vineyard wines also weren't a thing. And Dave just put one foot in front of the other and decided that that's what he wanted to do. And I find that to be audacious and also to be very much in the way that I like to do things. You know, you set your sail and you go in that direction. I think it's important to have an idea of what it is that you want to do. They're not inflexible. The line of wines have changed. And in fact, the Curry Creek Vineyard is no longer part of the stable of Red Newt Cellars Wines. I think they terminated that contract in 2018 or 19.
So is Curry Creek the... Curry Creek is the vineyard. Curry Creek grows the grapes, and now Correct. They're not making that anymore with Red Newt.
That's right.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, so this model allows them to change things around. One of the more audacious things that Kelby is doing right now is he is setting up a sect program, S-E-K-T, which is the German word for sparkling wine. And he's doing it very much in the champagne method. So he started this program in 2015 and has yet to release a wine because he's having these wines spend extended time, what's called untirage or post-second fermentation with their lees.
And that's a thing we do with champagne because they age longer. I learned that on our recent sherry episode in which we spent a shocking amount of time talking about champagne.
Yes. And it's Kelby and Dave's knowledge of wines of the world that allows them to be a little bit more nimble and quick-footed, and I think allows them to achieve some of the things that they achieve. For me, I can tell when a winery or a winemaker has a good understanding of the context of wines of the world.
How can you tell? Can you tell from the glass? Can you tell from a tasting portfolio of a bunch of their wines? Do you have to read some literature? Is it a meet and
greet?
It's
the second one. If I taste through, let's say, five of their wines, it'll give me an understanding of what they're aiming at. For example, Red Newt Cellars, give me any five of their white wines, and I'll be able to tell you this is a producer that's looking towards Alsace specifically for inspiration. If you give me some of their red wines, it might be a little bit more difficult, but I'd probably point to Burgundy as an inspiration, as well as some places in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia and New Zealand.
That's interesting. This is, again, an auteur theory parallel, not talking about the filmmaker or the vintner as the singular author, but talking about the body of work as telling us more than just an individual piece might. You're getting like two different ethos or two different artistic creative endeavors from them, essentially, based on which wines you're looking at.
That's right.
Well, what about holistically? What if just looking at, if I gave you any, let's make it an even number. Six of their wines, three reds and three whites. What does that tell you? Or what are Kelby and Dave saying through that?
That would tell me probably that these people are well-traveled and have a good knowledge of wines of the world broadly, but I might struggle to place it specifically. I just think it's really important to, I'm sure you can agree on the movie side, to have a context on other things that have been produced, other great works in the industry that you're working in, so that you can make a better product yourself.
For sure. I mean, at the very least, like, economically, right? Like, you have to recognize what the marketplace is. You have to recognize what there is an appetite for, what there is an interest in financing and releasing. I don't know if it makes it into the episode or not, but we talked about Kimmy. We talked about the new Soderbergh movie. Like, that was a guy who he made a movie in the aughts called The Good German, which is like a black and white post-war, very like pre-method style of performance and filmmaking. Like, he's really like hearkening back to Casablanca or The Third Man. And he just, like, the movie was very expensive. And even though it starred George Clooney and Cate Blanchett, like, it was a enormous commercial failure. And he's talked a bunch about how, like, he felt really upset about that. Like, he felt responsible to his partners and the distributor in the studio. And he's like, after this, I'm not going to misread the room anymore. Like, I'm going to really be careful about the marketplace. And I'm not going to do something stupid and irresponsible. Like, yeah, sure, give me, you know, $80 million to make a black and white movie about trying to smuggle spies out of West Berlin or whatever. So yeah, I mean, just like economically, you have to be aware of what's going on. But then also creatively. I mean, we talked a bunch in our last episode about how there's a lot of, and this is talking in a very broad, like, Hollywood studio way, about how there's so many movies that are in conversation with each other or that are building on these themes throughout all of these legacy sequels, which this movie is, like, very explicit and vocal, placing itself in that conversation.
And in the wine world, it's an interesting duality that exists between European wine and non-European wine. You know, the great generational estates of Europe, they don't necessarily have to have a great knowledge of wines of the world. They just have to understand how their family has done it for generations. And they have to have an understanding of, like, the farming methods that have become traditional in the area. Now, for sure, some of the newer generation does have that worldly knowledge and are applying it. But in more general terms, like, to make Burgundy, you just have to live there and understand the culture of Burgundy. The Finger Lakes doesn't have that. They started this project from nothing in 1998, and so they had to have that knowledge backing them up.
Well, what if hypothetically, they just, like, imported an ass ton of soil from Burgundy? Because then the T word kicks in and does the job for them, and then they can make Burgundy, right? The soil does all the work.
Yeah, you know, just a couple thousand metric tons of limestone soil from Burgundy,
yeah,
on a boat across the Atlantic Ocean, put it really wherever. It's not important.
Just dump it right along the sandy, loamy shores of the Finger Lakes. I don't know. Is it loamy? Do they have loam up there?
It's mostly slate and schist-based soils up there.
I did think I tasted some slate in this wine.
But no schist?
I don't know what that is, and also I did not taste any slate.
Schist is actually a dominant soil type in the Delaware Valley, where we live.
Huh. But that's not where this wine is from.
That's not where this wine is from.
Okay, I'm not interested then.
Yeah, so that's what I have to say about Red Newt and about this wine. I fucking love Kelby and Dave. And I wish that I had had the opportunity to meet Deborah. I think that from everything that I've heard, she was an amazing person. I think all of their wines are spectacular. And this one in particular, I find to be really, really compelling.
I'll go one step further, because compelling is oftentimes a word I'll use for a wine that I don't like, but that it's a backhanded compliment. Yes. It's compelling. Like, when somebody walks out of a movie that they just saw and they don't want to say that they didn't like it or didn't get it. So they say, oh, the cinematography was gorgeous. but no, I don't find this compelling. I think it's super tasty and extremely drinkable. And for, I don't know how this scales in terms of pricing, but for an 8-year-old vintage for $28 a bottle, that's not too shabby.
It's pretty insane. For a single vineyard wine, $28 is truly insane. You don't get this value. This wine you know, if I were pricing this wine in their tasting room, I would be asking $40 at least for it.
Well, Jamie, you're a real capitalist right there.
Listen, man, this stuff is rare. It's hard to make. It took up space in the cellar for a long time.
I'm not judging you. I'm not judging you. I'm just trying to, you know, upset you. That's all.
Well, you got a rise out of me.
Indeed, I did. All right. So Jim Jamborino, put this on a continuum with the previous four that we drank, not just in terms of the flavor, but like, why are we drinking this now after the three bottles that we've just had so far in this miniseries?
All right. So full disclosure, this miniseries is half United States wine. And that's because I am half of this podcast and I get to be self-indulgent and I am a citizen of the United States and I like American wine. So I wanted to start with the context of Italy and France, because I think it's important to understand, you know, where the grape Pinot Gris slash Grigio comes from, but then make the transition to the US and to see some of the intriguing and different styles that arose here. I wanted to start with Red Newt because of the three that I chose, it is most closely tied to Europe. This wine for me is Alsatian in style. It's obvious that they drank a lot of Alsace wine and understand the culture. And so the wine is a result of that. We're going to harvest at a certain sugar percentage. We're going to aim for acids in whatever range and create this wine. So I think it was important to understand that concept and the idea that non-European producers really do need to understand the context of European wine, because these are European vines. The other thing that this wine does that none of the other wines in this miniseries do is show the ageability of the grape. A lot of this miniseries is, you know, me creating a straw man argument for myself of the Santa Margarita model of the alcohol water that is just used to get drunk. Part of that is a wine that is completely not ageable at all. Certainly wines, Pinot Gris from Alsace are known to be ageable, but I really love the idea of having this New York State wine that you wouldn't expect to last this long, still showing so vibrant and youthful, and I think could age for another 5 to 10 years.
Well, what would it taste like in another 5 to 10 years? What's the difference?
I think the fruit character is going to get more confectionery, more cooked, more dried. That marzipan note that I talked about is going to become a little bit more dominant. You're going to see a little bit more of that, the mineral influence, that sort of slate kind of situation, and also the savory components, specifically the white button mushroom and the saffron are going to come a little bit more to the forefront.
Hmm. And these are all desirable outcomes for you.
Yeah. I think that wine would be delicious.
Do you have any bottles stored away for 5 to 10 years from now?
No, because I am a man of little patience.
Fair enough. Well, you should just get drunk and then hide one somewhere, and then you'll find it when you go to move again.
That is wise, Scott.
That's not the worst idea.
Scotty, what? Of all the things that I said about this wine, and I said a lot.
I'm looking at my watch. You said all the things. Yeah, there is nothing else to say about this wine.
There is definitely more to say. I could go on for a while, but we have things to do today.
Yep.
So I want you to tell me, of all of those things that I did say, what made you want to talk about Tom, Tiff, and Smith?
Well, so your whole thing is about partnership, and it's all about collaboration and how the collaboration is, you find that audacious and how that expresses itself in the wine, and there are different like business models and shit. And like this whole movie, a lot of it thematically is about partnerships and tension in partnerships and like great and also terrible things coming from collaborations between two peoples. It all centers on the relationship between Tom slash Neo and Tiffany slash Trinity, but also the relationship between Tom, Neo, and Smith.
And those, like, this is just kind of, not just, but this is expounding on what was said in the previous trilogy.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, so the architect lays it out for us that, you know, Neo is different from his predecessors as the one because his connection to humanity is very specific vis-a-vis his love for Trinity.
And we have to say vis-a-vis every time we talk about it.
Why wouldn't you? but then also the tension with Smith, right? That Neo is the one. He is the remainder, the anomaly in the equation of the Matrix, but Smith is his parallel, his counterpoint in the machine world. Smith is the first ever machine one that rises up. And it's only in their synthesis at the very end, right, when Smith tries to, again, spoilers for a 2003 movie that most of you have probably seen, but when Smith tries to, like, take over Neo's body, that some new equilibrium is achieved. And that just continues throughout this movie. But also, like, this is just an excuse to talk about these three characters and three, I think, really terrific and fascinating performances to watch.
We're going to start with Keanu, right?
We have to start with Tom slash Neo slash Keanu.
Okay. I want to say for the record that I know that there had been talk or that there had been a conception of Keanu as not a great actor
right.
for some portion of his career.
For much of the 90s and I would say until, I don't know, like this like what they're calling the Keanuissance, this post-John Wick period where between the big box office success and the creative success of the John Wick movies and his, you know, very like internet friendly, memeable personality that like people have kind of reclaimed him and they're giving him a second shot, which is fucking bullshit because he was always great. He was miscast sometimes, but like his like very like affable, doofy dude affect, people just like wrote off and thought he was dumb and he's not good and he's not a good actor, which is crazy.
That's what I wanted to say. Like I've always been all in with Keanu. Anytime I see him, I love him. I think he's great.
Even when he's miscast, he's great. One of my like favorite all-time movies is Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh my God,
yeah. And Keanu is like insanely miscast as Jonathan Harker in that movie. And he doesn't really crack the English accent at all. But you know what? Like the physical and emotional performance that he delivers is terrific. And like that's the thing about Keanu that people have never really given him a pass for is that like he's not a guy that you would necessarily want to give a Shakespeare monologue to, as maybe evidenced by, again, him being miscast in Much Ado About Nothing. But like it's still a good performance. Keanu's strength, I've always felt, is as a physical actor. Like his physicality, the way that he conveys emotions is incredibly strong and effective and clear. And you know what? Somebody from the same generation, somebody who's had a lot more acclaim and accolade, who I think has the same division where like they're better as a physical and emotional actor than they are as a, let's say, a literary actor, like a deliverer of dialogue, is fucking DiCaprio. I think DiCaprio is amazing physically. And just sometimes when he speaks, I hear him reading dialogue. Not always, but sometimes. But yeah, so Keanu has always, he's been dinged with that he's not a good actor and people are finally coming around to it. And I'm fucking glad because he's wonderful. And when he's cast well, he can do terrific things. I think he's amazing in this movie. Which I've never done before, I basically put together like my own Oscar ballot for this year, which we'll probably have talked about on last week's episode. But like, I felt like a crazy person for doing it, but I put Keanu in my bracket for best actor of the year for Resurrections. I think it's a fucking fantastic performance.
I think a lot about his performances in the, and I know we're going to get there, but in his scenes in the coffee
analyst.
Shop with with Tiffany.
Oh, with Tiffany? Yeah.
I think there's an easy read on that performance in those scenes where of him as not being good. But he's managing to convey this like teenage awkwardness translated through an older man. That is a high wire act, and I think he achieves it in a huge way.
Yeah, he also just like he underplays it. He underplays all of those scenes, and I love that he's not going for it in a big way. Like, I don't know if I would attribute it to a teenage boy feeling, but, you know, that way that it's been a while since I've had a crush on anyone. I'm looking at my watch, and it's been, you know, I've been with the same person for many a year now.
How many years, Scotty?
Well, shut up. I've had several glasses of wine. Normally, I'm the good one who knows these things. Come on,
man. 17
years since we started dating.
Not you and I, my now wife and I.
Yeah, you and I have been together for 25 years.
I wouldn't call it dating, though, Jamie. We're just, you know, friends with detriments. The giddy, like what you attribute to a teenage crush, like the giddiness, the nervousness about being around her. But then there's also all of this maturity, like especially with him and with Trinity, Tiffany, Carrie Ann Moss. But in general, the movie, like it feels like the people behind the camera, Lana Wachowski in particular, but also the cast have grown up in the intervening 20 years, which of course they have. But it's so nice to see that reflected on screen. Like, God, you talk about their scenes in the coffee shop. I love those scenes. The like electric chemistry between the two of them. That's not just sexual, but I mean, they're obviously attracted to each other, but there is a chemistry and attention to they're compelled by each other. Even, yeah. And like, obviously, like the two of them don't know why. He probably has a better idea at the beginning of their encounters in the movie than she does. We've talked about it before. It's chemistry, right? That they just react to each other and they spark in this really compelling way. And then their conversations are great. I love the little moment when they meet up for coffee, the two of them. And we kind of cut in halfway through the conversation. And I would have just watched a whole feature film of the two of them talking about being adults in a coffee shop. Like, that shit is magic for me. But when she talks about her kids and the difficulties with all that, and she's like, well, you know, and he just kind of – he has this great little grace notes. He kind of puts his head down and he's like, no, I don't know. I've never had kids. And then her delightful, like, sheepish embarrassment where she's like, oh, shit, I shouldn't have said that. And like, oh, that's right.
I Googled you.
God, it's so good. It's so good. The way they play these great little adult conversational moments. It's like, I don't know, it's an acting and a directing masterclass. I genuinely think that the performances and those scenes are so fucking great to watch together. But people don't talk about it. People don't talk about how good he is in this movie.
100% agree.
You know what really gets me every time I watch it? It's this one tiny note. It's his first scene with Smith, where he's in Smith's office and there's a little bit of antagonism going back and forth, and Smith is about to drop the big reveal on him, the line about our parent company, Warner Brothers. But he asks him in this super fucking passive-aggressive way, how's the therapy going? And Keanu's reaction, immediately he stiffens up. There's this rigid quality to him. His eyes narrow, but like the tiniest fraction of a degree. And he kind of cocks his head slightly to the side as he says, fine. You can sense this whole relationship between the two of them. You can sense like that the therapy is a problem between the two of them, that Tom knows that there's an antagonism and a passive aggressive question that's coming along with, you know, Smith just asking.
And maybe even like, maybe this is me ascribing things. I got the sense on, I don't know which of my watch throughs that maybe the therapy and the suicide attempt are the reason why Smith is the boss.
Yeah, and also that he's kind of telling us that, like, no, the therapy is not going fine. Like, not only is this conversation between the two of them not going well, but the therapy itself is not going well, and fuck you for even asking. Where are you with Keanu, Jamie? I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that you haven't seen any of the John Wick movies. Is that correct?
I have not, and now I really want to.
They're a fun one. So like the first one, if memory serves, it was very nearly going to be like a direct to video thing. And then Lionsgate, I don't know if it was Keanu's pressure or whatever, but like it was a decision to release it theatrically.
When was the first one released?
2014, I want to say. The first John Wick was 2014. And it was like a medium success. Like it's very much like, you know, like an action programmer. It's a revenge story and he's a used to be an assassin and he's coming out of retirement and yeah, I guess I'm back. And he goes and like kills dozens of people. But yeah, so Keanu's performance is great and all of the action is terrific. And it really pushed American action back towards something that was more about conveying choreography and the reality of stunts and like a clean geography. You know, it's not just like all shot in close-ups and fucking cut to hell like all of these like European Luc Besson factory Liam Neeson movies. The first one is directed by Chad Stahelski and David Leitch. Stahelski was Keanu's stunt double in the Matrix movies. He's in this movie. Really? He plays Chad, Tiffany's husband.
The first one was like a medium-sized hit, and it was, you know, a big thing on home video and digital and streaming. And then the second and third are gigantic, and they're making a fourth. And I personally, I love the John Wick movies, like, for the action and the world, and the casting is really fun. Like, you always get this great scenery-chewing Ian McShane performances. And the second one, or the third one, has Common as another assassin, and he fucking rules in it. The third one also has a really, really awesome couple of scenes with Halle Berry as another one of his assassins. But they kind of like brought him out of the wilderness. Like post-Matrix, I don't know if it was a typecasting thing or just like he was picking the wrong roles, but like Keanu didn't really have a hit post-Matrix until John Wick. He had a bunch of near misses and some movies that people have kind of, you know, reclaimed or kind of loved, but he never really achieved that level again. And then John Wick has kind of like brought him back sort of at like a B movie level of like major movie star status. And now he's back here. And I just find him infinitely compelling to watch.
I concur. I mean, fucking back to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, loved him in that. I think he's great.
Damn, he can do so much too. Like, obviously he's amazing as an action performer, but he's got great comedy chops. But yeah, and then with this performance, like all of the notes that he gets to play, I think you and I have talked about this, that like something that we really loved, and this kind of plays into in our last episode talking about Lego sequels, is this idea that like most Lego sequel heroes, Tom/Neo is dragged back into this story that he thought he had settled decades later. And instead of just like having him be an action figure that you plug into, you know, battle scenes to keep going with it, the movie interrogates that question of like, well, wait, what the fuck are we doing to this poor guy by making him go through all these beats again?
And he's just so tired. You can see it on his face the whole damn movie. He's like, I'm so done with this shit.
I don't want to do it. I don't necessarily believe that this is all real again. I don't want to fight. I don't want to fight the same battles again. Smith, I'm not interested in you. I don't want to wage war against the machines.
The only thing he's interested in is Tiffany.
Yeah, he just wants to save her. We talked about it a little bit last time. We must talk about the White Rabbit montage.
It's so good.
So Tom, if you haven't seen the movie, which is insane that you're four episodes into this miniseries so far, but bless you for still being here. Probably the standout sequence of the film, I would say, other than the finale, the like rooftop jump finale.
Yeah.
But the real standout sequence of the movie, and one of my favorite scenes in all of 2021 films, is this montage after Tom's first visit to his therapist. Neil Patrick Harris is the analyst, and he's just like chugging these blue pills. Presumably these are like antidepressants that he's taking, slogging through this montage of horrible fucking meetings at his video game developer company that he founded and now seems just like an employee of, while everybody's trying to tell him what the Matrix is and what the Matrix means. Keanu is so funny and plays every note so pitch perfectly in that whole sequence.
I have a lot of thoughts about the sequence, but the treadmill him situation, amazing, and obviously a very on-the-nose metaphor, but I'm here for it.
Right. And just calling back to Morpheus 2 when we see him on a treadmill as well.
And then the rubber duck, him in the tub with a rubber duck.
What does that mean to you? Because that meant nothing to me. And then I had to do a little bit of digging.
It seemed to me like it was a foil for the White Rabbit, right? Like rubber duck means sitting still, while White Rabbit means diving into the rabbit hole.
Oh, interesting. I didn't think about it that way.
I also don't have a lot of context on like what actually, I'm sure that there's historical context on rubber ducks and their significance as a bath time toy.
Yeah. I mean, just first of all, it's just a funny visual, right? Like in the middle of this montage of him like slowly going insane while all of these like demented cartoon characters of game developers who are all like a full generation or two younger than him are trying to tell him what his great work meant / his great life experience meant. And they're all super reductive and he's chugging these blue pills. And then we just get this one fleeting shot of him in a bathtub with a fucking rubber ducky on his head. So I spoke with friend of the show and a computer programming expert extraordinaire, Ryan, and he kind of unpacked for me what a rubber duck actually is. And yeah, so here he is.
No, you're talking to a rubber duck. I thought I was very clear about this. Rubber ducking is not something I would say to a fellow software engineer. I would probably call it rubber duck debugging, like if I was trying to tell a junior engineer what the heck it is. Man, it's just taking a rubber duck or other inanimate object. You use it to help debug your code. You know, you go and you point the duck or whatever it is at your code, and you go line by line explaining what each line does so that you can root out logic errors or anything else that you're forgetting in your code, to like some edge case that you're not thinking of, like, oh, well, what if this value comes in and the value should never be zero, but like, what if it is, right? Like, did we account for that? So those are the sorts of things that you'd use rubber duck debugging for. I don't know, lots of people swear by it. I didn't totally use it a lot. I always felt, for me, it was always helpful to like just talk to another person. It's literally you are talking at a rubber duck so you can verify that the logic that you've written in your program makes sense. You specifically, if I were to talk to you specifically about a program that I was writing, it is beneficial that you don't know what I'm doing. If I were to talk to maybe one of my teammates, they would probably know a lot more about the innards of the system and maybe you know, derail my train of thought, because they'd be asking very specific questions about certain paths or certain, I don't know, like I said, inputs that maybe I didn't think of, right? And that's not super helpful when you're rubber duck debugging. That's something, getting an expert's opinion on your code is nice in like a code review, where you can get that collaborative support. This is just so you don't like mess with anybody else's train of thoughts, right? You're not interrupting a team member. You're just talking to yourself. But that's the other thing too. That's why, you know, us programmers use rubber ducks, is because generally we're in the bathtub when we are debugging our programs. It's a little bit harder to do in the shower because the rubber duck falls off your head.
So in the movie, like, this is another case of the Wachowskis, in this case just Lana Wachowski, using something from the world of computer programming in a metaphorical way to kind of like reveal something about our characters or about our story, right?
Because he's trying to interrogate his whole life.
His entire worldview. He's sitting there and he's got the rubber duck on top of his head and he's saying, okay, am I going fucking crazy? Like, is this really the real world, or am I back in the Matrix, and are all of my memories actually just a video game and the whole thing is a lie and everything's been like dumped on top of me? Isn't that great? Don't you love that?
That is super fucking cool.
And for something that's totally throwaway. I think it has roughly as much screen time in the trailer as it does in the movie. It's like a wide shot and then maybe a close up and that's it.
I mean, it's just a good, like this is a despondent guy shot.
Something is wrong here. Even if you didn't just see him like eating a fistful of blue pills, like the rubber duck is telling us, like, this is aberrant behavior. Is he okay? I'm worried about you, Tom.
It's a whole sequence about how not okay he is. And it's a whole sequence that is like, I don't know, we're maybe spanning the 60 years of real time with this sequence.
Yeah.
Because they keep saying the same thing over again.
Over and over again. Yeah. I mean, this is something that you and I have talked about, that we both independently came to this conclusion. And I'm very proud of us for that. Pat ourselves on the back. But that
we're both very smart.
Very, very smart boys reading deep into the text of, I guess I should pause here. I haven't said this so far on the miniseries, and I do want to put out like a, not a disclaimer, but like, if you think that I'm saying that this is like an extremely subtle and nuanced text and that most people would not be able to discern all of these layers of meaning from the movie, that is absolutely not what I feel about it. Like, the movie is very blunt. I think it's very direct and explicit. And if you have like any like remote sense of media literacy or, you know, familiarity with like cinema beyond just like looking at the pictures and the plot, I think a lot of this is like readily apparent. And I'm just drilling down on it, not to explain it to people, but to use this movie as an example of like, look how much a movie can fucking do. Look how many things you can say, even if you're saying them all like at a very loud volume.
It's good that you said that. Although I will point out that we have used the words blunt and explicit like a lot of times already in this miniseries.
Right. I just don't want people to think that I'm like sniffing my own farts here and patting myself on the back for like delving deep into the hidden layers of this movie. Like, I think it's all pretty, not surface level, but it's readily apparent if you just want to look for it.
It says the things that it's trying to say out loud.
Yeah, quite out loud. But that's a tangent from, we both independently came to this, like, again, it's like a fan theory thing. It's not something you can prove,
but the idea that the reason that we see two iterations of basically every scene or line of dialogue with the game developers in the White Rabbit montage, every one of their like their key lines, like bullet time,
get up in their gray space,
get up in their gray space. We see all of those twice because, as the movie will reveal to us, Tom has killed himself in the Matrix at least once already, or attempted to kill himself, which is the moment that like awakens Bugs and helps her liberate herself from this new Matrix. The montage is literally showing us that this is the second time he's done it, which makes him feel even crazier because he has maybe some kind of repressed memories of the first time he went through the same experience.
Once again, this treadmill idea, like you're just getting nowhere.
It's very bleak, Jamie. It is an extremely bleak movie in the things that it has to say about modernity.
And I think we've touched on a few of those things already in our exploration of the apocalypse.
I don't think we're ever going back from that. Now that the cork is out, so to say, or so to speak, I will no longer be afraid to be a fucking bummer for our listeners. I apologize, dozens of you at home.
Scotty the bummer, too hottie.
I do not apologize. I have one last thing about rubber ducking, and this has nothing to do with the movie, and it is entirely about this show. Jamie, I think this show, or specifically me, I am a rubber duck for you.
Yes, I have felt that way.
I think that is a role that I serve.
Yeah, I'm forced to explain wine in different ways to you than I do to members of my own community.
And I'm a squeaky bath time toy.
No, you're not.
No, I can't fit in a bathtub anymore. I'm too big.
We've talked a lot about Tom.
And about Neo.
And then the White Rabbit sequence and rubber ducking and all of that. And we touched on Carrie Ann Moss, but there is more to say.
Yeah. You know what's crazy? She's like obviously second billed in the movie because like, as far as a Matrix movie goes, she's going to be the second biggest star, especially in the absence of Lawrence Fishburne. But like, it's wild to me that she's second billed. And it's also, again, referencing back to I'm kind of embarrassed that I made my own version of like an Oscar ballot. Like I had to really wrestle with whether or not she's a supporting actor or a lead actor. And she doesn't have a ton of screen time. Like, objectively, she's a supporting actor, but the performance is so good. She kind of dominates a lot of my memory of the movie.
I agree with that. Most of the most impactful scenes center on her, and in fact center on her performance. Let's talk for a moment about her introduction in the coffee shop. You know, you have what's the fucking douchebag character's name? Jude. God, he sucks. He's great, but he sucks.
Great performance as someone who sucks.
Oh my God, I would want to slap the shit out of that guy.
When Tom is like about to jump off the building and Jude calls him and he's like, Jude, are you alone right now? And he just kind of like swings the camera around. He's like, it's kind of a sexy question, dude. Such a great douchebag performance. I love
such
that.
Such a good douchebag line. And so Carrie Ann Moss walks in and Tom is obviously distracted by it. And Jude like matches eye lines and is like, oh yeah, her total fucking MILF. Or he says total effing MILF.
He says effing, which makes it even better.
But enough about Jude, because this is about Carrie Ann Moss.
We're adding an episode to the miniseries that's just about Jude.
I don't think there's enough to say about him other than like he's a douchebag.
The only other thing we should say about him is that he is played by Andrew Lewis Caldwell, and it's a great little performance. And okay, now there is nothing else to say about Jude. Please continue.
I'm actually going to go on to say one more thing about Jude, which is the one like cool thing that he does is introduce Tom and Tiff. He's the one who goes up and talks to her first and says, this is Tom. He's a world renowned video game maker or whatever. And then the two of them, it takes her a moment to like meet his eyes. And there's this moment as you like see the eye lines meet, you can see her whole face softens and she smiles.
Well, even just like she relaxes her shoulders and that the way that Lana holds on that insert of their handshake, that kind of like lingering handshake, it's gorgeous.
It truly is. And it's this interesting thing that Carrie Ann Moss is doing, I think, with her performance where it's like, there's this warmth and there's recognition, but also she's meeting a man, she's being introduced to a man in a coffee shop. And so her hackles are still are like a little bit up.
Right. Yeah. Is this a come on? Is this some kind of weird gross thing?
Which is tough to communicate in the 5 seconds of nonverbal time that she's given to communicate it. And I think it's masterful. I think it's wonderful. I think she's incredible. And we touched on their chemistry, which is off the charts.
In each of their scenes together, there's this little great little moment in, so Tom has been awakened and, you know, now he's Neo again and he's gone to the city and he's met Jada Pinkett Smith with all the goofy latex makeup on. And then he goes back in, right? And it's now it's my whole thing is just I got to rescue Trinity. And he goes and he meets her at her bike shop where she's working. And I don't know if it's before the bullet time or after, but like they have this very emotional meeting and he is like clearly like on edge and he's fraught and he slips and calls her Trinity. And just like immediately like her eyes go down. She's like, you shouldn't call me that. Like it's a good line and it's a good moment for the two characters, but like, God damn it.
For all that's going on that is surface level and loud and bombastic and big, a lot of the things that both Keanu and Carrie Ann are doing with their performances are so subtle and quiet.
Yeah. And I mean, it's got to help that the two of them have a history, right? Like they did those three movies together. That was a really important part of both of their careers and their lives. And they get to like rekindle that chemistry. But I think it's also just that like Lana Wachowski as a filmmaker has evolved and she's grown up and she's matured. And the things that she's interested in are not the things that she was interested in 20 odd years ago. You know, I think it's really telling that the most exciting scenes in the movie are the conversations between the two of them, or the conversations between Tom and Smith, or the conversations between Tom and the analyst. Like those scenes are thrilling in a way that the action scenes like dominate your memory of the first Matrix in particular. This is a ding that people have made against Resurrections, that they don't think the action is any good, which I largely disagree with. But I think it is, again, very telling that like the stuff that really clicks and that people largely agree upon and that we want to talk about are just these conversations, these gorgeous, intimate, delicate conversations between adults.
The one that always makes me really smile, and I'm sure that we'll talk much more about it in our next episode, but the final scene with Carrie Ann Moss and Keanu Reeves speaking with the analyst.
Oh my God.
After post-victory.
Yeah. It's so gratifying. There's something special about the way Carrie Ann Moss as Trinity like can make an audience cheer. I read this really good interview with her. I think it was in the New York Times, right around the time the movie was coming out. And she was talking about like how revelatory it was. Like the first time she saw the movie, because that was like her first big role, she like cried the whole way through the movie. And then the first time she saw it with an audience, like not like a test screening audience, but like, you know, an American audience, just like a casual, you know, civilian audience at a Cineplex. And the way that people responded and cheered for all of those great Trinity, like super kick-ass moments. And I don't know, there's just something in, it's a combination of the writing and the directing, but also the performance, but there's something about the righteous way that she stands up for herself and also dispenses violence and the way that she threatens people. She must be one of the all-time great on-screen threateners. I always love in the second one where, you know, they've laid out the plan and Morpheus explains that some people see there's three captains and three objectives and some people see coincidence and I see providence. And then Neo's like, but I'm, because of my dreams, I'm afraid that if you go in, you're going to die. And so she stays out. But then something goes wrong, I think because of Smith. And so Trinity has to go in and Link, played by Harold Perrineau, is like, you don't have a lot of time. You've only got 2 minutes. She's like, in 2 minutes, I'll tear that whole goddamn building apart. Like, fuck yeah.
That's so good.
She's such a great like audience avatar. You just like, you want to cheer for that character. And I've told you about it. It has happened each of the four times that I have watched the movie, but at the end in the final like coffee shop scene where, you know, Neo has made his deal with the analyst essentially that like, if she chooses to come with me, you'll let us both go or all of my friends will unplug me. And if she doesn't, then like fucking fine, you can take me. And she comes in and he can't make the pitch. And then, you know, the conveniently Chad and her kids show up and the cat is lost in a tree or some stupid bullshit. And as she's leaving, she looks back and she sees that Neo is in trouble and fucking Chad's got his arm on her hand and like, Tiffany, come on. And oh my God, Jamie, I cry every time when she turns around to him and says, stop fucking calling me that. I hate that name. My name is Trinity and take your goddamn hands off me. I get so emotional every time. I'm getting emotional just describing it right now. It's really intense. Great performance.
It's a little bit of a silly line, right?
Oh, it's totally silly. But you get a great actor like that who's so invested in the character, and she makes it sing.
Yeah, she fucking absolutely tears up every scene that she's in. She dominates, as you said. Her and Jonathan Groff like dominate my memories of this movie.
Well, let's talk about him. Let's talk about my boy, fucking Groff. we talked about this before. I forget who we were talking. Oh, we were talking about Kevin Bacon when we did our Marvel episode. And I talked about his villain in X-Men First Class that I said he was a delicious villain, right?
Yes.
And I think Groff as Smith is a delicious villain. Like he is enjoying it so much.
Just being bad seems so much fun to him.
Yeah. And it's this like weird, I don't know, because Hugo Weaving, I don't know if he was offered the part, but like he was definitely in talks to come back and have a role in the movie. And then I don't know if it was COVID or something else, but it just came down to like he was not going to be able to come and do the film. And so the way Jonathan Groff tells the story is that his agent calls him up. Lana Wachowski wants to meet with you about a project. It's very secret. I'm not allowed. I don't even know what it is. Do you want to meet with her? You have to get on a plane and talk about the project. And he's like, Lana Wachowski? Yes, sure. Of course, I will go and meet with her. And he gets on a plane. And it was like, I think it was like only like while he was in the air that they were like, all right, you're going to read for The Matrix. And he's what? And they just had like this long conversation about like philosophy and worldviews and like travel and shit. And then she's like, yeah, I want you to play Smith. And he's so unexpected. Like there's nothing, you put Hugo Weaving and Jonathan Groff next to each other and like not just with their bodies of work and our associations with those two, like, you know, Hugo Weaving, we typically think of as like, he plays heavies and he plays villains, and like dirty, grungy, like morally complicated characters. And then Groff, we know mostly from his Broadway work.
Right.
And like nobody knew that he was playing Smith. I don't think I didn't know until, you know, they straight up fucking tell you in his first scene. And I just love so much about him is that he's like, Groff is leaning into all of these notes in the character that Hugo Weaving only ever like nodded or winked at.
What notes did Hugo Weaving nod at that Groff is leaning into?
Well, the fact that he is obsessed with Neo in a borderline romantic way.
Right? Okay.
That like Hugo Weaving, you would get a bit of it. You got the sense that there was an obsession and that there's a playfulness in their banter, especially in the second and third movie. He enjoys being around Neo again. He thanks him for liberating him. The dialogue, he really makes a meal out of it. But like there's this sense that there's an affection and a respect between the two of them, even if Smith ultimately wants to destroy him and everything in the world. But then in this one, like Groff just like straight up leans into it, especially when he comes back, right? After he's been awakened and he realizes that the analyst has just enslaved him the same way that he enslaved Neo. He comes back and they have that gigantic, ridiculous warehouse fight. And the line that you mentioned, I think last time or the time before about the piercing blue eyes, like he just leans into it. He leans into the camp a little bit.
Yeah.
Stuff that was kind of always there with the character.
I just smile every single fucking time he's on screen. Like from the very beginning, we're introduced to him and we're given that like flash of Hugo Weaving, which communicates to the audience in a very subtle way that this is Smith. But then you begin to realize that, oh God, Smith doesn't even know who he is. Like you realize in that scene that neither of them understands.
Right. Yeah. The relationship is the same, but that they're not aware that the context is a prison.
I think that there's probably a read on that scene where you're thinking that Smith is in control, you know, that Jonathan Groff is like the puppet master in the situation.
For sure. Yeah.
But I honestly, and I've thought a little bit about it, probably not enough, but I don't know what it is about that scene that so effectively to me communicated that he also doesn't know what's going on. that the both of that, that Smith is very much living his life as a video game executive, and is not there as some kind of a contrivance.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I also can't place my finger on it. I haven't really thought about that. I mean, it might just be the sincerity of the performance, you know? Whereas, like, with NPH as the analyst, like, you kind of clock him right away as the villain. Like, there is just a sleaziness that Neil Patrick Harris can bring to something that is 99% repressed in the early analyst scenes. But, like, they're you don't cast this guy just to have him be the likable, sympathetic therapist. With Groff, like, she tells you right away, this is Smith. This is the big bad guy. This is the relationship. This is what Neo remembers. This is the antagonism. And yet, yeah, I think you're right. I don't know why, but I think it's just something in the sincerity of his performance. Like, he's enjoying his role, right? Tom right. is not enjoying being Tom again. He wishes he was Neo. The game for him was almost this like wish fulfillment, and also what he thought was like a psychotic episode. But
Smith is here at the top of the food chain. He's in control. He's got Tom under his thumb, which is what Smith wants, no matter what the situation is.
Let me ask you, this is something that friend of ours, Ryan, our computer programming, let's say recurring expert for this miniseries, that he posed to me that I hadn't fully thought about, but it's kind of been rattling around in my brain. So it is shown that while for Tom, like for the audience, it feels like 20 years has passed since the events of the trilogy, and that for Tom, it feels like 20 years have passed, maybe since he made the trilogy, that timeline is kind of murky. But that even though it was really 60 years, like they talk about this 20 years and the time that Tom and Smith spent with their company Deus Machina. I do like that it's not Deus Ex Machina. It's not God in the machine or God from the machine, but just God machine.
God machine, yep.
But with their company that they made the trilogy, do you think that... And this is, again, like this is just unpacking a plot thing that I think is interesting and maybe feeds into the performances and the richness of it, but it doesn't actually have any impact on, you know, the truth or the reality or the themes of the movie. But I just want to know what you think. Do you think that in this new Matrix that the analysts made, that Tom and Smith together, like, founded a company and made these games based on not just Tom's memories, but collectively, like, both of their memories? Do you think that actually happened? Or do you think that these are... like false memories that the analyst and that the machines or the digital sentience that they implanted in the two of them?
I think they did it. I think they made the video game together. I think it was like just reconstructed animosity between the two of them. You know, they were forced in a situation where they had to collaborate. And that's it, as much as Trinity and Neo are the force that keeps this new Matrix running, so are Neo and Smith as this like Magneto situation. They have to be put very close to one another, but not touching.
Are you talking about like an actual, like an electromagnet, or are you referencing beloved comic book and movie villain Magneto and his antagonistic
an electromagnet.
Relationship? Okay.
As much as I love talking about Magneto, and particularly Michael Fassbender's Magneto.
Fassy Magneto. Yeah.
It's a good one. It's a real good one. But no, I think that in as much as this matters, because this is bordering on fan theory, right?
It does not matter. I find the question compelling. And I think the movie poses the question.
I do too. And I like the headcanon where Tom and Smith are making the Matrix video game together.
Like they start out as equals and then Smith... whether it's because of Tom's suicide attempt or something else, like Smith like wrestles control of the company from him.
And that's where the tension and the history and the animosity and the everything in that first scene in the office where Smith then reveals that they have to make another Matrix and that he's excited to do it. And he's excited to do it because It gave him so much more power last time.
Well, and because he knows that it's going to break Tom even more. I think, like, he's such a prick that he knows that, like, he's winding up. He's so excited. That's what the question about, how's the therapy going? Good. Oh, okay, great. That was a lie. Wonderful. Then let me just dump this on you and watch it fucking wreck your world, that we have to go back and do this shit again.
Ay, ay, ay. Yeah, it's heavy. What do you think? Do you agree with me, or do you think that it's implanted?
I feel like, again, like, this is a thing that doesn't matter, but my guess is that it's implanted, and that the whole relationship of Tom Smith is fabricated by the analyst. Especially since, like, we know that they started it over, right? Like, Tom tries to throw himself off a building, and then when he doesn't fall, they basically hit a reset button and they start the level over. And, like, at what point do they start it over? Do they start it over all the way back when they made the trilogy? Probably not. They probably started over, like, back before that party happened or something. Right. So my instinct is that it's all a fabrication, but, like, either way, like, I say this a lot, and it's not because I'm an HBO Max stan. It's just we keep talking about Warner Brothers properties, but, like, I would watch a whole HBO Max miniseries about Tom and Smith trying to make a series of video games, and, you know, Tom trying to be artistically pure and Smith just making something that's crass and commercial. Like, some version of, like, the Apple TV Plus show Mythic Quest, except with Keanu and Jonathan Groff, which I would find infinitely more watchable.
We've talked a bunch about Groff, and we've basically only talked about that first scene.
Yeah, which is a fantastic scene. But then he's terrific in all of it. His fight scenes are fucking great. He has probably the best fight scene in the whole movie. He and Neo's fight scene, like, in the bowels of the warehouse building. Yep. Terrific fight. So many great character moments. Yeah, I could gush about that performance all day.
We talked in our Marvel episode about how Wesley Snipes is really good at posing like an action figure.
Yeah.
There were a number of moments in that Neo Smith fight in the bowels of that building where Groff is doing that thing.
That, like, is in a whole different comparison. Way,
not
yeah.
like Wesley Snipes does, but like an action figure.
Yeah, he's such a refreshing presence in an action role, because there are so few, like, out gay men who are, like, allowed to be action heroes or, like, action characters at all. I don't know. He just stands out in this really interesting and compelling way. And he's such a wonderful physical threat, too. What Groff brings to it, this, like, very modern, like, sort of millennial presence and sensibility and line delivery in that character, is part of this thing that I've hinted at a couple of times, that I think there's a real, like, generational commentary in the movie, like, talking about, like, Lana being, you know, a Gen Xer. Tom, Neo, Keanu are Gen Xers, and, like, they have to hear from all of these millennials and Zoomers about what they think the Matrix really is. And I find it so interesting to see Smith, the big antagonist from the first movie, is now placed in the body of, like, this gorgeous, like, millennial in the visage of Groff. It's brilliant casting. Like, you get so much mileage out of his casting and the baggage and the associations that the audience brings to the screen just from the moment he shows up.
You describing him and his background and all of that just reminded me, because as I've mentioned to you, I just finished watching Sense8, and the theme in that show, not the theme, but the storyline in that show of Leto coming out and losing his status as an action hero.
Right.
I wonder if that wasn't, like, a fully deliberate move on Lana's part.
I'm sure she thought about it, right? Like, she is clearly an extremely thoughtful filmmaker, and, like, no decision, no meta-text of any casting or visual or aesthetic choices goes by without her thinking about it. I don't know if it just tickled her to cast him that way, or if it was just, like, a happy accident. But, God, I just think it's marvelous, and I think it makes for a really amazing and, like, effective recharacterization of that. I think much more effective than the Yahya Abdul-Mateen II version of Morpheus 2, which I don't fault the actor for. I think the performance is great. I think that character is maybe just, like, a little bit half-baked, or maybe, like, shorted, like, one or two scenes in the final edit that would really make him have this, like, beautiful arc that really clicks and lands in a great way.
Yeah, your walk to the edge with him in the scene between him and Neo, where we're, like, worried that Neo might die or whatever, and they're in the construct and they're fighting. That, I think, is a setup for maybe another scene that gives us catharsis or some amount of, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know, giving that character full realization.
I think he has a payoff. And I think there's he kind of disappears for a good chunk of the middle of the movie, which makes his payoff not land. Something that really stuck out to me in my last viewing of the movie prior to my gorgeous 4K showing up very soon. In fact, I'll have it by the time everyone listens to this. You guys should be so happy for me. I'll have my Matrix 4K.
I'm very happy for you, Scotty.
Shut up, Jamie. You'll have watched it with me again by the time people listen to this. Not that this is the Morpheus episode, but he also gets his leap of faith jump moment, right? Like at the end during the big plan, Morpheus takes over the little nanobots or whatever, and he has to make a leap from Neo's pod to Trinity's pod. And the movie doesn't hammer it home super hard, but he's in the physical world, you know, he could actually, you know, if you die in the Matrix, you die in the real world. Well, if I would imagine if you're a program who's loaded yourself into a physical machine body and the machine body falls or is destroyed, then you're gone as well. He has to make that moment of well, I'm willing to risk death to go and transcend and do a great thing and also prove myself to all of these people like Neo, who maybe have doubts about me. He has that great moment, and you're just missing a scene or two of setting up why that's a big payoff for that character.
I think also that may have been a better payoff if we got more of a performance from Yaya himself.
And not as a mocap robot?
Yes. It's a cool concept.
Oh, it's super
rad. It is not great at capturing a great actor's performance.
I concur with that. Even though he did all the mocap himself, but you're right. It does kind of sideline that character.
But once again, this is not the Morpheus episode.
Last episode should have been the Morpheus episode, but we talked about bugs and modals too much. So you didn't steal my thunder, but you hinted at this, and this is kind of why I wanted to talk about these three characters is the tension between Neo Trinity, Neo Smith, and also maybe Lana and Lily, right? So so much of the movie is about how this new matrix of the analyst can't exist without the love conquers all super sappy power of Neo and Trinity's love that somehow metaphysically is powering the entire matrix and makes it all work. But simultaneously, it can't work without Neo or Tom, Neo and Smith in close proximity to each other and their antagonism and their antithetical, bipolar oil and water nature, also creating tension and agony and frustration. And also that the two of them, through their antagonism and their frustration, they have a working relationship that produces something very profound. In the world of the Matrix within the Matrix, they make the trilogy that seemingly everybody loves and, you know, redefines the zeitgeist, just like the movies. Though I am averse to talking about biography so much, as I talked about a few episodes ago, I can't watch all of this and not think about how this is a filmmaker, Lana Wachowski, who this is her first feature film and only the second creative effort that she's done not working with her sister Lily Wachowski.
Which is, that's huge.
Yeah, they did basically all of their creative endeavors since even before they were in college together. They fucking started a construction company together. And they worked at Marvel Comics writing together. Yeah, they did construction for a while, even though they didn't really know entirely what they were doing. They've done all of their professional endeavors prior to Lily stepping away from Sense8 towards the end of season one. Prior to then, all of their works were done together. And I just can't help but see that tension and that absence and maybe that longing represented in the movie.
Yeah, it definitely feels like it's there.
And this is not I haven't heard anything like this in the interviews and so I had avoided talking about this before, but we should talk about it since it's now thematically relevant to our discussion. Lily Wachowski said in interviews last year that she stepped away for myriad reasons here. This is from what she said in, I think it was in Television Critics Association panel or something, talking about a new show that she has coming up. But she said sometime in 2021, Lana had come up with this idea for another Matrix movie, and we had this talk, and it was actually, we started talking about it in between our dad dying and our mom dying, which was 5 weeks apart. And there was something about the idea of going backward and being a part of something that I had done before that was expressly unappealing. And like, I didn't want to have gone through my transition and gone through this massive upheaval in my life, the sense of loss from my mom and dad, to want to go back to something I had done before and sort of walk over old paths that I had walked in. It felt emotionally unfulfilling and really the opposite, like I was going to go back and live in these old shoes in a way. And I didn't want to do that.
You can't falter.
You can't falter at all. It makes perfect sense why she wouldn't want to do that. And I do think it's interesting. Like, Lana has talked about how the impetus for the movie for her came out of their parents dying. Her mourning and her longing and just missing her parents got her thinking about Neo and Trinity and how much she loved those characters and how much she missed them and what it would mean to bring them back, both to her and to audiences and to them. Like, what am I going to do to these characters? The way that Neo longs for Trinity, it doesn't feel even necessarily sexual or romantic. It's longing for a partner, longing for someone that used to be half of his life, that used to be like half of his reason for getting up in the morning and saving the world and doing his Superman thing. Like, he basically, Neo's whole mission for the whole back half of the movie, once he comes out and sees what the reality is like, I got to go back in and get my partner. You know, she's my collaborator. I don't care about anything else. I got to go back in and get her. And we can only do it together. Like, don't ask me about starting the war and fighting against the machines and freeing minds. Like, I need her before I can do anything else. And not that I think that, like, because allegory is boring. And I don't think that, like, this movie is an allegory where Lana is Neo and Trinity is Lily. Like, that's weird and flattens something that's really complex and spiky and layered. And again, biography, not super interesting to me, but I just found that very compelling and a very personal thing to find in this movie that, you know, on paper is just like a very cynical cash grab.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been, but it's very much not that. And I mean, unfortunately, that's borne out in the cash that it has made.
Yeah, the not very much money dollars that it made.
Because the movie itself is just so earnest and so thoughtful and so extraordinarily different from the films that came before it. But yeah, I think you're right. I think that kind of a partnership, when it's torn asunder, leaves a piece of you missing. And so it makes sense to express that longing in whatever art you're making.
Jamie, if you ever decided to stop doing this podcast with me, I don't know, I'd probably have several hours in my week that I would get back, and God knows what I would do with them.
Yes. When you're not around, Scotty, I miss you like the deserts miss the rain.
Well, I mean, I didn't want to assume, but yes, I did know that. I would love to see more of these characters and like other iterations of these characters. And certainly, like, I would love to see more of Bugs and of Groff Smith and of Morpheus 2. But it really feels like this is the fucking end. Like, Matrix Revolutions was like the period on the end of the sentence. And this is like the fucking three exclamation points on the end of the sentence, like underlined with red pen and circled and highlighted, like, Jesus Christ, please listen this time. It doesn't seem like she wants to do any more with it, but I just love these new versions of these characters. I would love to see so much more of Groff as Smith.
Yeah, I mean, give me a movie where Neo and Smith are actually fighting. Like there's a campaign against, like, the two of them are fighting, and the analyst is like fully this neutered character who's trying to assert some amount of power, but really you just have Neo and Trinity versus Groff.
Yeah, would love it. I hope this just instead, because I don't think there will be more Matrix, and I don't know how much more you can mine out of it at this point, unless, you know, we just wait another 20 years in the future and then 70-odd-year-old Lana Wachowski comes back and has even more to say, which would be fucking fantastic. And late 50s Scott and Jamie will just fucking lap it up. I just hope this opens up like a whole new area of casting opportunities for Groff. Because yes. I think it shows this crazy range and all these things that he can do that we didn't really know about before.
Yeah, I want to see him in something huge, not like an MCU huge.
I mean,
like
that feels inevitable, Jamie. He'll probably be in one of those. Everybody has been at this point. Some of them has multiple characters.
I just threw up in my mouth.
All right. Well, so Jamie, I don't have any wife takes today, but she does have one of her like very clever open-ended question prompts here that I think will tickle and antagonize you.
Love that.
All right. So her question, Jamie, After Neo and Trinity paint the sky with rainbows, what wine-related thing should they improve? For example, deleting the word t- from the vocabulary, or eliminating all cork taint, or subtly reducing the influence of Robert Parker et al. This is patronizing. She's patronizing you right here, and you deserve it.
I'm not even going to dignify it with an answer, just to say, like, all of those things, let's get rid of the idea of t- and fuck Robert Parker. And yeah, let's all stop using natural cork, for fuck's sake. There are alternatives, and we don't have to worry about cork-tainted wine if we don't want to. So just stop it.
But is the other stuff, like, eco-friendly?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
absolutely it is.
Well, then screw it. Or screw it. Use the Stelvin closure, everybody.
The Stelvin closure, use DM, which is a cork product that has no chance, or has very, very small chance of cork taint. Whatever synthetic possibilities there are, like, natural cork is bad and not sustainable, and is ruining the forests of Portugal, among other places. So, like, let's not do that anymore.
Okay, great. So in Jamie's headcanon, priority number one for Neo and Trinity in remaking the simulacra prison of reality is to go and get rid of natural cork.
Yeah, let's go ahead and say that.
Wonderful. All right. Well, Jim Jam, next time, I believe we're drinking – hang on, look at my notes here. Scroll, episode 5. Yeah, so next time we're drinking Pinot Grigio. Do you think you could tell the audience what to expect next time?
Yes. So next time, from the Irie Winery in Willamette Valley, Oregon, we're going to be drinking their Pinot Gris 2019, which is available at B21. That's B-21.com for $22. Now, if you happen to want something a little bit beefier, a little bit fuller in body, a little bit more expressive, coming from older vines, go ahead and spring for that extra. They do a bottling called Original Vines, from the original vines that David Lett planted in the 60s. That one is $44, and it's the 2017 vintage that's current right now. That wine is truly special.
Do you have a food pairing to go along with the Irie?
With the Irie? I hadn't thought about it.
You never do, Jamie. I mean, you never do.
I mean, I usually do, but to be honest, I don't. I'm not going to get into it. The first thing that comes to mind is like ceviche, crudo, sushi. So like raw seafood would be really great with the Irie Pinot Gris.
Word. That's wonderful. For the first time ever, I will have a food pairing to go with one of the wines we've been talking about for 36 goddamn episodes on this show. Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
To me, for asking you.
All right, Scotty. What are we talking about from the movie side? What really granular, annoying little piece have you extracted from this one movie to talk about for a whole episode next time?
Well, I mean, since we got so much mileage out of talking about three characters, let's really challenge ourselves, and I only want to talk about the analyst next time. This is the analyst, character played by Neil Patrick Harris, another delicious douchebag of a villain. He is Tom Anderson's therapist and revealed to be, fucking spoilers, the new architect, the creator, the grand vision behind this new version of The Matrix. So I want to talk about the analyst. I want to talk about some metatextual readings, how that character kind of figures into how The Matrix weaponizes everything against us. And we'll be talking about a little bit of French postmodernist philosophy.
I am excited for it.
Me too. I've been doing some heavy reading, and this episode better fucking pay off, because otherwise, why in goddamn hell have I been reading all these books?
Oh, man. I'm going to be very excited to try and like annoy you while you're talking about French philosophy.
All right. Take us home.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you.
Please, if you haven't already, follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. If you have questions or concerns, email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. Please also, verbally, in person, or over the phone, if you'd like, tell your friends about the show.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our social media presence is thanks to Jamie Harrison, James Rubin III. That's him right over there.
Remember, everyone, please drink more wine, watch more movies. It's good for you, we promise.
Bye, everybody.
People do what they want to do. No shame, no shame in the game out here.
Do you even know what the sex act is? Maybe you like the sex act, Jamie.
Maybe I do.
You know what?
Never
I don't mind. Know this what the is sex not a road I want to go down with you on this podcast.
No,
or
let's go
ever.
Ahead and Google it right now. Peach ring sex act. Thank you, Google, for recording that.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And Zoom peach for ring. Recording it. And also me for recording it.
A peach ring, according to Urban Dictionary, is an extremely stretched out butthole due to excessive anal sex.
Okay. Yeah. That definitely sounds like something that needed a candy-based euphemism to describe it, for sure.
Do you want me to read it in a sentence, the way it is in Urban Dictionary?
I would be very frustrated if you didn't.
I'm sure that this will get cut from the episode.
1,000%.